Welcome back to the Mom Mentality Show. I'm Austin Chadwick. This is Chris Lucian. And we are really excited to have Amitai Schleyer with us. Did I get the name right?
That's me. I'm Amitai.
Right on. And we got some great topics lined up. Before we get started, though, do you want to tell us a little bit about yourself?
Sure. My name is Amitai. I'm a software development coach. Depending on who I'm talking to, I might say technical agile coach, if that's the kind of thing that rings your bell. But sometimes you have to stay away from the word agile because people have a lot of associations with it that may precede me that aren't related to what I want to do with them and only get in the way. So I like to sit with programmers and program, sit with testers and test, sit with managers and manage. I love to put things in terms of cost and risk and to help developers think in terms of cost and risk. One of my areas of specialty is legacy code, which we'll talk about a bit. And one of my missions is to make the world safe for programmers, because we got that one from Kent Beck, and it's one that I've taken to heart. So we'll talk about that too.
Awesome. That sounds really cool. Yeah, so I guess diving into our first topic, we got coaching and mobbing. So what are your thoughts to get the ball rolling here?
Well, for me, there's a strong synergy. So I've been a tech coach for about 5 years now. And my first couple go-arounds, I was doing my best with what I had to work with, which was not a lot of training. An intuition. I got really lucky in my personal life and married someone who did a PhD in social animal behavior. So how animals influence each other, how they really learn from each other. So when I was trying to make a career change from being a developer, which, you know, I had the mental model that I love words. If I just stack all the right words in the right order with the right frame of tone of voice, then people will have to agree with me and then behavior change will occur. Yeah, you know, just like I had a lot invested in that worldview that words are really important and I've practiced them a lot. And if I just get them right, people will do what I want. One small problem with that is that they don't. So I had to take that to heart. The wordsmithing didn't go nowhere. It's still really useful when you have earned somebody's trust and their willingness to experiment to be parsimonious with your language and to be clear and to give them, you know, a specific idea in a very few words. Or, you know, if you're making a podcast such as We Are Here, or I have been making my own on and off for some years called Agile in 3 Minutes, it's really useful to be able to put the words that way. So it's not that it was fruitless. It's that it wasn't effective in the way that I thought it would be and something else would have to be. And I got lucky talking over the dinner table with my wife, what she's reading, what she's writing, this academic stuff about how non-human animals, but also human animals, succeed at influencing each other's behavior a little bit at a time, was a great frame shift for me as I was trying to make that frame shift professionally. And I got lucky again because she decided not to be an academic. She decided to study another master's to become a therapist, a counselor. And she's finishing that program now. And one of the things people tell me as a coach sometimes is that a conversation with me is like therapy. Not that it is therapy, because I am not qualified for that. And as long as we stick to like work situations and not out of my depth, but just to hear that and then to, again, have someone at home who actually knows what that's like and can give me good input on that. So that's what coaching turned into for me. It didn't start that way. And then I got really lucky, and that's probably where our paths would start to overlap, that I got to pair coach with Llewellyn Falco. And I had already been familiar with mob programming by that point, just from Twitter and from him and from Woody, various other people. And I had used an experiment of it in my first client, even though I didn't totally know what I was doing. I thought this might help some of the situations that I'm seeing here, and it did. But it really kicked it up a notch when I got to pair with Llewellyn. I did a week with him at a client of his, and then I did a week solo at that client of his. And that really showed me this topic that we're talking about, this synergy that I see between mobbing and coaching. And I can think of a couple different angles on it. One way to think about what a coach's job is, one way that I often frame it, is what behavior changes in these people when I'm not with them. And so a really expensive way to try to get a coach is to have a year's budget and bring them in for a year, 4 or 5 days a week for a year. And then a year after that, have them leave, and see what changed. That's a really expensive way to see. A much cheaper way is the way that Llewellyn does it, and that I like to do it now, which is to have some kind of a cadence, an iteration, you could say, with a feedback cycle in it, where you visit them for some amount of time, and then you're away for some amount of time, and while you're there, it's enough time to form a new habit or not, and when you're away, it's enough time to keep the habit, if it really made sense to them in their context, or to lose it if it was just me breathing down their throat. And if I have visited you 3 or 4 times and none of the stuff we tried ever sticks, you should stop paying me. That sounds like agile to me in a way that a year of a software craftsmanship coach doesn't. And so I love that idea. And then I also love how that's actually a very tough assignment for a coach to fulfill unless they have a way to observe the team doing what it's doing and influence the team doing what it's doing in the span of, say, a couple weeks. It's not a long time. So this is where I see the first part of the synergy. It's that when the team is mobbing or when the team is willing to mob when I'm visiting, then I have a place to stand. You know, I have a lever. I want to move the world, but I have to stand somewhere. And if they're mobbing, then I can see. In fact, they can see each other too, which is maybe the next thing we could talk about. But I have a way to see, and I have a way to... I'm going to have like 74 ideas of things that could change for this team. And I'm going to pick 1 or 2 today. And maybe another 1 or 2 tomorrow. Something like that.
Yeah, much so more iterative. The first part of
synergy is... Yeah, go ahead.
So yeah, much more iterative, small batches, limited work in process, right?
Yeah.
It sounds very lean, very agile. Do you, when you approach a client and say, you know, and suggest that this is the way that you're going to work, how is that typically received? Like, what are the types of reactions that you've gotten when you've proposed working that way?
It depends how I pitch it, and I didn't do a very good job to begin with. So one version that I don't recommend for you independent consultants out there, when a client says, we have budget for a year and we'd like to retain you to coach our team, don't say, I don't work that way. That's not right. Then they will look for somebody who does, and there are people who do. Another thing that isn't great is to say, how else did I do it? I'm sure there were other ways that I said that were off-putting. A good way to say it is, cool, let me suggest a way to structure that. And then I get into the kind of thing that I just told you, where you could spend all that money every day, although at my rate, maybe not. But at my rate, you could afford, and it would actually work better if we had this cyclical pattern. And if you're trying to do agile, that should appeal to you. And the option to stop paying me should appeal to you. And so that has worked a lot better.
Nice.
And then as part of that discussion, do you talk about how you'll be working with the teams, if it's going to be mobbing or not? Or is that just kind of implicit, or you kind of inspect and adapt once you're there?
I strongly suggest that they set it up the way that Llewellyn likes to set it up, which is there are at least 3 teams because each mob session is going to be 1.5 hours, 2 hours max. That's a lot of focused attention for a team, especially if they don't usually mob, but even if they do, to have some outsider with this strong personality giving them ideas and steering them more than they're used to being steered. They have work to get done. They have ways they're used to getting it done. 2 hours is a high end. 1.5 hours is good. So you need at least 3 teams so that a day can go by without overloading anybody. And I suggest that this is the most effective way I've found so far, because it is. I'm willing to try other ways, but I'm also willing to say when I'm trying it another way, this isn't going as well as it might. And can we consider restructuring it?
Nice. Yeah. So another follow-up question is, I suspect you've done coaching mobbing style and non-mobbing style. Is that true?
Yes.
Yeah. Okay, so what are some of the compares and contrasts with that? Yeah.
The absolute biggest one is coaching a team not in a mob takes way longer for me to orient to them and for them to orient to me. And if you've done some mobbing before, it kind of stands to reason. I'm like a new employee. And onboarding in a mob is relatively quick because you don't have to know everything to contribute something. And getting to know the social dynamics of a team in a mob is relatively quick because they're all happening in front of you. And these are things that you miss, especially as a coach, I would say, because those are your main levers that you have to pull if people are soloing or pairing or not all working together in some other way. So again, it's possible to work that way, but I have found it more effective when we're all together.
Nice. Yeah. So it's kind of like maybe an efficiency and quality gain for coaching. That's been my experience only doing internal coaching, but trying both ways. The non-mobbing way is a much longer path in my experience, and also much harder to influence.
Yeah, it's not only efficiency, although I guess you could make the argument that like from zero influence to a non-zero influence is a kind of efficiency. But it's also about the kinds of discoveries that you can make when everybody's together. Or, this is another part of the synergy, when I'm there as a coach, then people feel like they're under a microscope a little more, even if we don't want them to, they will feel that way. And one of the big questions is, what can I notice and how can I intervene? And of course, that's happening. But that's not the only thing that happens. Teams also start to notice themselves better and intervene in their own behaviors better. And merely by being there and being the kind of person like, what would Amitai do? He would ask us to consider what happened there. Well, okay, so let's consider what happened there. And I don't need to be there for that to happen, which is awesome. So it's not only, you know, how much faster can we make improvements? It's what kind of improvements do we get to notice to consider making? And the options go way up when we're all together.
Sure. So when you so earlier you said that some, you know, if people are willing to work in a mobbing style, have you had people where they refused to mob up front and then gradually over time started mobbing? And what did that look like if you did?
Yeah, for sure. I can think of a couple contrasting examples. One team, the first team that I ever suggested mobbing, which was my first coaching assignment that I ever had, it looked like there was like a team within the team, people that were extra close with each other and extra distant from everybody else. And I wasn't the only person that had started around the same time. There was an employee and a contractor. And so we got different versions of being on the outside of something that's going on the inside. It took me a long while to crack that nut of why that was that way and what was really happening. But one of the things I tried along the way was, with the blessing of the program manager, I basically asked her, can you come to this team that is having a lot of trouble working together and say to them in so many words, we're going to do this experiment where we work as a whole team. You have not only my blessing, but my, you know, we're used to getting demands over there. So this is kind of a demand, so that you understand it, that in the next iteration, if you don't get fewer stories done, I will be disappointed because you weren't trying hard enough to learn something. And, you know, in practice, what happens when a team tries my programming for the first time? They don't usually slow down that much, but they need to hear that they're allowed to so that they can try it for real. And that's what I had this woman say. And they heard it, and they, you know, I think they maybe got one fewer story done, which is in the noise. And the result of that is that the person who usually liked to keep the decisions for himself close to the vest was on his best behavior, speaking out loud, talking people through what he knew. He was the expert. And people who had previously been unable to be involved or unwilling to be involved started to engage with the problem-solving process and getting to know their own domain and getting to know their own code in a way that they hadn't before. And the whole team was energized by this. So that's one way that it can go, is that you have to manufacture the willingness based on the culture that precedes you. And the culture that precedes me needed a little pressure for it to work. I don't love that, but that's what seemed to be needed there. Usually what I prefer is some kind of an invitation. People who want to try it should. People who don't should not. I don't want anybody there who doesn't want to be there. I would like them to be within earshot if they could, or at least I'd like them to be able to hear the stories of how much fun it was later, because sometimes they will change their tune. And the flip side is maybe they have some good reason for not wanting to join, that when I see how the people who are mobbing behave, I'll have some insight and maybe I can work on that and make it a more inviting place to be. So in general, Not the first way. In general, the second way.
Yeah, absolutely.
Yeah,
right on. I think we should transition topics right now. I'm sorry to break the flow that we had here. But we had this topic of mobbing legacy code. And so I imagine that there's a lot of benefit to we experienced this, I think, when we have chunks of legacy code that we have to deal with. We'd like to hear kind of your take on mob programming with legacy code, and what are the benefits, and maybe what are difficulties, if any, and what's your perspective?
So the one way to think about mob programming is it's more extreme than the original extreme programming. If we were to define XP now with what we know now, we would have skipped pairing. We wouldn't be doing that. We would just be working as a whole team on the same computer at the same time. And legacy code is a kind of nexus of extremes as well. Even with code that's, you know, a pleasant place to live, that's covered by tests, that is easy to refactor, that the domain jumps out at you, even in that case, we are dealing with the limits of our knowledge on a daily basis. And in legacy code, which various definitions, I like to say valuable code that we're afraid to change. This is kind of like the Feathers definition, where having tests is a substitute for having confidence, or maybe like a specific way to have confidence. But really, it's the confidence that we need. And when we don't have that, we're afraid. And any way that we can get away from the fear is good. So legacy code is a case where the cognitive challenges of software development that we always have are turned up all the way. And mobbing is specifically not a panacea for this, but it's as good as anything I've seen. Precisely because it's not up to any one person to have a complete mental model of something that nobody can have a complete mental model of. It's up to all of us, as we are considering changes, that there are enough of us in the room, we have enough of a variety of opinions, we've had enough of a variety of experiences to know what to look out for, that for any given change, somebody thinks of the consequence that we need to have thought of before we move. And in a mob, your chances are way better. In a pair, they're better than nothing. And solo, it's really, you know, it's you against the world. But in a mob, you have a chance that you don't otherwise have. And then that's just the beginning. I mean, there's also an aspect of, you know, how did the code get this way? What are the social factors that led to it being in this condition that makes it hard to move? And when we're all together, you have those positive peer pressure aspects of, okay, now that we understood this, can we do a few quick things to make it easier to understand next time? Or now that we figured out how it works, let's write a few quick tests so that it describes that next time. And when you're solo, you might not have the willpower for that. You might not have the executive function to say, I just got through that. I'm kind of exhausted, but responsibly I should do a little bit more. But in a group, you make slightly better decisions when conditions aren't optimal. And in legacy code, conditions are never optimal. And so, again, your chances are better.
Nice.
Yeah, absolutely. I can definitely relate. Yeah, when fear is the highest and legacy code is there, it's being solo in that situation is not fun. I mean, you can make it fun by like embracing the challenge and going after it, but the gut feel is always like, I don't know what this is going to do, or, you know what I mean? And so for one, the tribal knowledge. So if you have people who have been around a while, the tribal knowledge of like, oh, if you touch that, that's going to touch this thing, you know, have an impact on this thing 50, you know, files away or whatever. And so that confidence goes up. And then it's just amazing to me how many times, here's the safest way to do this change with the least amount of fear. But then someone else in the mob speaks up and it's like, oh, that way's way simpler and it's way safer. You know what I mean? And I was just about to do this risky thing, you know, that I thought was safe, but there's an even safer way. And so, yeah, I definitely second that. It takes away a lot of the fear and makes it much more enjoyable and safer, code safety. So, yeah, it's cool to hear the same for you. I guess any follow-up questions to Chris?
Yeah. I mean, so as far as the learning aspect goes with the legacy code and onboarding and things along those lines,
yeah.
I'm sure that works in such a way. So in these coaching experiences, are you coaching in in order to get a group of people to work with legacy code better? Or what's the relationship between the coaching and the legacy code portion?
There's a pretty strong correlation. In general, I mean, you could say just like everybody needs therapy, everybody needs coaching. There's some sense in which that's true. But who decides to get therapy and who decides to get coaching, that's not everybody. And it's a little bit self-selecting. So, for example, a startup that doesn't have a lot of code yet and is just in a hurry to try to find some product market fit, they're probably not thinking, how do we make this more livable yet? Because they're not necessarily going to live there. Even if they have, you know, VC money out the wazoo, it wouldn't occur to them to spend some of it on a coach. And they might not be wrong. By the flip side, most of my clients, as it happens, are big companies that have been doing something for a while. They're really good at doing that something. Increasingly, it involves software, but they maybe don't realize the centrality or the primacy of software to their business. They might not see themselves as an IT business. They might actually be one. And they haven't been privileged to learn from people who have seen the best. They don't even know what the best could look like. But they are in trouble because they have something that is slogging through making them some money and they're having trouble changing it. So there's a really strong correlation between which companies have the budget because they have legacy code, it's valuable, and have the need because it's legacy code and it's hard to change. And so more often than not, those are the places where I wind up, and that's why legacy code became kind of a special fun specialty for me. In fact, I just gave a talk the day before we're recording on an open source project based on a legacy email server that is still really awesome, but is really hard to change, and I revived a community project around it. In fact, I have a 90-minute or so conference session, a workshop that I've done a dozen times, conferences, coding tour that I did a couple years ago, meetups. It's called Strangle Your Legacy Code. And it involves, it's lessons that I learned from working with this email server code, where we have a real strangler that I provided. The email server is written in C, and it's actually written in really idiosyncratic C, by that matter. And it's like 20 years old, but the architecture of the software is beautiful, which is why it's worth living with. And so what I propose, the scenario of this workshop, Strangler Legacy Code, is we all have worked together for 20 years. We've all invested our email service in extensions to this email server. And I just thought with my 20% time, because we work at an enlightened company where we have 20% time, that if I could come up with a proxy around the SMTP server, then we could develop enhancements like the enhancements on our backlog for the next quarter in a different language, maybe like a memory safer language or an easier to develop language than C. And do it faster and do it more enjoyably and do it test driven. And so I provide a strangler and I provide some red tests. And as a group, we go through and try to understand, you know, what actually the strangler itself isn't beautiful. And this is all for purposes of the discussion at the end, which is if we were going to interpose the strangler application pattern because we think that refactoring is too costly for too long and we want to do something about this legacy code, then what are the risks we should be concerned about with the strangler? Starting with, how do we know that's not going to turn into legacy code? And so kind of by design, the strangler that I provide is imperfect. And the way that we make the test pass is expedient. So that by the time we've piled up a few features, we're wondering a little bit about how this is going, and then we talk.
That's awesome.
So
That's cool. Yeah. So, I'd be looking forward to see if there's anything put out from that talk, and be good to see that. Cool. Next topic. What do you think?
Yeah.
Kind of round it out. So we've done coaching and mobbing legacy code, and now we got
coding for non-coders.
Yeah.
So coding for non-coders. What you had suggested this topic? It sounds really interesting. Where do you want to go with it?
Well, so it comes from. First of all, the way that I am positioned in our field, I don't have a computer science degree. I think I took a data structures and algorithms class before I dropped out of college. And I don't remember much, but I remember the insight of, for any given problem, what I need to be able to do and how I organize it are related, and probably somebody has thought about this before. That was enough of an insight to make me a little smarter. But that's all the computer science education that I have. I've been lucky as a hobbyist to be involved with NetBSD, which is an open source Unix operating system, and to meet people from that have been tremendously influential for me. But my theoretical background is thin. My practical background is really all I have. And I am not, you know, I'm not an expert programmer. That's not what people bring me in as a coach for, to know their programming language better than they do. I don't need to in order to help them. But so I'm not an expert. What I have figured out by way of expertise is something to do with how I orient myself in a problem space and how I help other people orient themselves in their problem spaces, which is a pretty good superpower for a coach. But because I don't feel like the best programmer that ever happened, in fact, I feel like I'm just barely good enough, and all the stuff I learned from XP is what keeps me in the game. That's why I still have a career. It means that I can relate to people who aren't technical, I think, a little better than people who really feel solidly in their programmer identities. And I can relate to programmers pretty well, too, which is handy as a coach to sit next to programmers and program with them and ask the right questions and be useful to them and earn trust. So programming for non-programmers arose out of how I'm positioned in relation to people that I work with. And it's also inspired by Kent Beck's idea from, I think, the original XP book, which is to make the world safe for programmers. I think if you look around, it's happened here and there, but it's not widely distributed. And I was thinking about this a lot on my coding tour that I went on two summers ago. And it occurred to me that maybe the way that we make the world safe for programmers is that we need to make teams safe for the non-programmers. I think it's still the case. I see this at Agile Coach Camps, for example, where it's still unusual to be a technical coach at an Agile Coach Camp. I remember my first Agile Coach Camp. We opened with like an affinity grouping exercise, and the initial prompt was, I am technical, or I am a developer, or something like that. And there were about 55 people there, and about 48 of them ran, not screaming, but they went pretty quickly to the edges of the room, and about 7 of us were in the middle. Just like, I kind of knew this, but now I really see what we're up against.
It's like the Constellation retro, right?
Yeah, and I just thought, like, man, you know, coaching is tough work for me. It must be really, really, really tough for people who can't relate to programmers or don't feel that they can, thereby making that true. So I took it as a mission for that coach camp, and I've been expanding on it ever since, to try to give people who aren't programmers just some taste of what it is like. So that, not that they need to turn into developers, if they love it that much, great. But what I'm in it for is the relationships between the people on the teams. That developers feel...
Somebody who is a non-technical person or a non-technical coach that is in the group of developers that's feeling maybe separated or something.
Yeah, somehow like estranged from the, like, I don't feel qualified to sit next to you and have a conversation, which is terrible because you're a human being as much as they are. They're a human being as much as you are. Both of those are true. And it's just a matter of they specialize that way, you specialize this way, but you absolutely can have a conversation. And if I can just demystify it a little bit, and you have a slightly positive, small experience about what it was like when you sat with some code and some people, then maybe you can leave and have a conversation that you didn't feel like you could have before. That's what I'm after. I'm about the relationships between human beings. And coding for non-programmers is almost a red herring. It's just what we're doing to get there.
Yeah.
Mm. Nice. Yeah, and so maybe to get more practical... So what are things you do to kind of help bridge that gap specifically? Like for me, it's kind of happening naturally in a mobbing environment. Like someone from the business comes by and they have some questions and we have a meet at the mob station, and to answer their questions, we're like looking up code and kind of talking them through it, like translating from the code to business to be like, oh, this is what's happening. And so I have a sense that probably helps it feel demystified a little bit, like, oh, this code isn't this weird thing that no one can understand. I can kind of get a feel for what's going on. So just kind of inviting non-programmers to be part of the mob, at least little bits of time, I've seen help. What are tips and tricks you've seen to help bridge the gap?
That's great if you can do that. And when I'm with clients and I have the opportunity to do that, I do it. In the wider world, at meetups and conferences and coach camps and what have you, I just make sure to always offer a session. In fact, I'm doing one at the Global Scrum Gathering in New York in May with Faye Thompson. It's called Two Midwesterners Politely Invite You to Explore Coding. I live in New York now, but I'm from the Chicago area and she's from Ohio. And so we figured for New Yorkers, we should be very explicit. This is people from the Midwest. We will be nice to you. Yeah. And so I do something like that solo or with the pair in this case, whenever I get a chance, so that people who manage to go to conferences, which is a great way to push your comfort level, can come away with, like, my strategy when I go to a conference is not, is there something that I could become an expert at? You can't. But what could I effectively do in an hour? I could go from totally ignorant to having like a point on a map in my mind. And so, again, people that aren't developers aren't going to turn into developers, but in an hour they might have a point in the map of their minds of what it's like to do this and how to talk about it when we're talking about it with each other so that I can go and try it. And what I'm doing in those sessions really is just being me. I don't know how to describe it. I'm not very intentional about it. I'm congruently being myself, facilitating the room. I know how to do FizzBuzz in Python in CyberDojo with test-driven, but that's not the point. And in fact, it's really helpful when I have a co-facilitator who doesn't. I can go as far as I can go with my friendliness, but someone who's there in charge and also doesn't know goes a lot further. But that's what we're doing. We're doing it in public. We get volunteers to mob on it. We get ideas from the audience. We try to have some sense of humor about the whole thing. We refactor when we feel like we went far enough and it's going well. I just try to involve them in the same way that I facilitate a team full of programmers. Just the knobs are turned a little bit. Just like when you're navigating and the developer is new, so you talk about keystrokes and menu items. Or the developer knows this code base really well, so you talk about classes and extractions and whatever. It's the same thing. I'm navigating people who are at the beginning of that rather than further along.
Awesome. Nice.
Yeah.
Okay. I think we're kind of at our time box now.
Yeah.
Is there anything that you wanted to say or plug or anything along those lines before we sign off here?
Sure. I mentioned the Strangle Your Legacy Code workshop. That's a 90-minute thing. I don't have any sessions in public scheduled right now, but I'm happy to offer that remotely. There's the Global Scrum Gathering in May, where I'll be doing Two Midwesterners that I just mentioned with Faye Thompson. That's in New York City. And then one other thing I could specifically mention is the Agile in 3 Minutes podcast has an episode that really is 180 seconds or less about mobbing. And so if you're listening to this show, you may already have a pretty good idea, but if you need to hand something around to teammates or coworkers or managers to give them a picture of what it is that you're trying to get them to try, 180 seconds or less may be to your advantage. So we'll put that in the show notes.
Sure. Definitely. Great. Yeah.
All right.
And finally, just me as a consultant, you can find me at latentagility.com.
All right. Sounds good. Thanks for joining us, everyone, and thanks, Amitai, for being part of the show today, and it was a lot of great topics covered. And so to our audience, if you feel like this video could be important to somebody that you know, please share it with them. I think that's the most important thing that you can do for content like this, is make sure that it spreads out to the people that need to hear it. And so like and subscribe, and we'll talk to you later. Bye, everybody.
See ya.